Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Objective. Today is Philosophy Friday, and we're also going to be talking about something that you might not expect. We discovered on an episode of the Daily Objective that my co-host and I are both a little bit punk rock. And what that even means could mean something very different to different people who grew up even just several years apart. So we're going to find out what we even mean by punk rock. And of course, since this is an Ayn Rand student type environment, we're going to like kind of explore what it all means. Like how does the philosophy of Ayn Rand relate to entertainment and art from an era which is very sort of, at least on the surface, antithetic to Rand's aesthetics. We'll get into all of it, I hope, and I'm sure we will. Please welcome a guy who looks like he just stepped out of SLC Punks, a guy who he apparently was an objectivity workshop. Not exactly where I would go to find, fairy dust or whatever type of drugs the kids were taking. Please welcome Dr. Jason Rhines.
Hey, how's it going?
Decent. So I like the look. So you got a little bit of blue or something in there, or is it just the
Yeah, stuff? It was supposed to be a very dark black. It was like the color was called Starry Night or something like that. And then I did it and I was like, wait, that's not black. That's like midnight blue. And then I read the fine print after the fact, which was not recommended for largely gray hair. So lesson learned.
Well, lesson learned. Anyone out there thinking of dyeing your hair? If you want it to be a bright color, first bleach it and then bleach it again. So now your hair is really bleached, then dye it and it'll shine.
Oh yeah. No. I wasn't, if I wanted bright blue, I would have bleached and then dyed. I wanted black. And mm-hmm. So, you know, best to do dark on dark, but with salt and pepper, you know, it came out blue. So
gotcha.
So I may do another coat. I don't know. Whatever.
Might as well go with it. You know, go hard or go home. Although we do live in an era now where really the only punk rockers left probably have gray hair. This is sort of a period piece, I guess. Okay. So what does punk rock mean to you? Like what are some of the bands that come to mind, or like kind of what comes to mind if you could?
When I think punk rock, and when in particular, I think like what are the most sort of iconic punk bands for me, I think late 70s. So I think Sex Pistols, I think The Clash, I think The Ramones, The Buzzcocks, like that kind of period. And then if you ask me more thoroughly, like what else are punk bands, I'll give you more bands from the 80s and 90s that I think are still, you know, punk. And then if you ask me, you know, like, well, what about like the music? Then I'd say, well, actually, like I would dig back into the late 60s and early 70s for stuff like the Stooges and the Modern Lovers, even some of the stuff the Velvet Underground was doing and some of the stuff glam rock like the New York Dolls were doing. And then I also like, just in terms of my tastes, I also really like kind of 90s like and early aughts, even like what's sometimes called post-punk. So stuff that's still sort of lo-fi rock that has a bit of an edge, but is not quite punk. So, you know, like my favorite band is the Pixies. But I think of them as post-punk rather than punk proper. But these categories are highly amorphous.
Interesting. You're probably about the same age as Kurt Cobain would be if he were alive, I'm guessing. I don't really know how old you are exactly, but like,
maybe
I know
I think a little younger than Kurt Cobain.
Okay. Well, you would know, cause you were probably a lot like you probably comparing your age to his when he was around, but.
And when I say a little younger, I mean like 14 years younger than Kurt
Cobain. Oh, wow. Okay. I haven't done the math. I know he died 25 years ago. So I guess, sorry about that. But I know like he was like into the Pixies and all these like 70s and 80s punk bands. And he ended up taking it in a kind of a different direction. So like grunge was sort of like a like a stepsister of punk rock and kind of that whole thing that became.
Yeah. I mean, it's these genres are funny because like I was reading a bit about how none of the main, say, like emo bands, when they started out, thought of themselves as emo. You know, they thought of themselves as a rock band. They thought of themselves as a grunge band. Like, and then they were this. None of the grunge bands started out thinking of themselves as grunge bands. Like, we're just in Seattle doing like lo-fi rock. Like, what, you know? So, you know, the how they get defined and what they get defined in terms of is probably something we should talk about, because I think that partially musically you can see some through lines in punk, but not strictly. And there are songs, you know, on some albums and from some bands where you say, like, if this is punk, then why isn't that punk? And if that isn't punk, then why is this? And there isn't really a good answer, I think, sometimes.
Right. So maybe journalists play a large role in kind of like categorizing what they see happening. And then people think, oh, yeah, there's the grunge era. There's the punk scene. There's this, there's that. But really, it's a bunch of independently driven musicians who are kind of they've got their own set of influences and they're creating their own sound. And it's not always so cut and dry.
Yeah. I mean, one reason I think we talk about scenes is, you know, like it's not quite political enough to call it a movement, you know, or something like that. But you have collections of people who have shared interests, who have shared fashion senses. And by shared, it doesn't mean they all have the same thing. It's just there are overlaps. And certain bands go on tour together and certain bands play the same venues. And certain ones are like, if you like this band, you'll probably like this one too. And I think over time, you know, like a genre just kind of gets defined by sort of reifying and putting a certain kind of stamp on a scene or a kind of musical undercurrent. And I mean, I think, and you know, if you think of it, I mean, like, it's not all that different from a political party, you know, like if you say like, you know, like, well, what's a Republican argument? And you're like, any argument a Republican wants to make to advance their political goals. But like what brings somebody into that political tent is a variety of different ideologies and interests. And you can kind of say at a given time, like, yeah, that's an argument the Republicans are using, or that's a talking point or something like that. But is like a type of, it's not really great as a typological category. It's timeless or something like that. I don't know. I think I think that there are music genres where, I mean, music theory is like one place where I have tremendous deficits. I never really learned to play an instrument and I don't really understand it. But I mean, I think there are certain genres where like you can discern definable musical features that recur and that they have in common. But I think with a lot of popular genres, it's pretty difficult to do that. And in a way, it's a good thing that kind of, to some extent, I think that bespeaks the rapidness with which they evolve and grow out in different directions in a free society.
Mm. Yeah. So, okay. You know, we've spoken about Judaism and history, and so I know much of history shows like Jewish people studying their religion in secret, like, you know, like if they get caught, it's death. So that for me, ironically, was coming from a fundamentalist Jewish upbringing. To me, punk rock was the thing I was secretly consuming. At 11, 12 years old, under my blanket at night with the volume turned almost entirely down on my tape player, listening to The Offspring. That was like the big one. The Offspring, Americana, which, you know, people a couple years older than me would say, Americana, that album's crap. It's all about Smash, but really Smash was the sellout album. Really, it was, you know, Ignition. It was what the minute a band becomes popular, the hardcore punks are like, this is trash.
I mean, I remember when Dookie came out and Green Day, everybody said Green Day had totally sold out And I don't think they sold out. I think some of their stuff was a little more like accessible at that point, but I think, you know, I think they were still a great band. But they never escaped like the stigma of that album going supernova huge. And I mean, like, even at the time, and I wasn't like a punk kid, but even at the time, like, that album was so saturating everywhere and everything that I had this sort of reactive aversion to it. Like, I'm not going to be like the millionth person to just listen to this and so on. But like, but gradually over time I revisited it and I was like, yeah, this is a great album. What was I thinking?
Yeah. You ever find yourself kind of like turning your back on something that once meant something to you? You're kind of like, oh, I grew out of that. But then you later on, you kind of come back to it with a fresh set of ears and eyes. And you're like, wow, this actually was as good as I remembered, or I can see why it inspired me so much. I never should have turned my back on this. Is any of this?
Yeah. Although I don't always say I never should have turned my back on it. Like sometimes I'm like, yeah, I needed to grow out of that to change enough to reach this new point where I could appreciate it anew. Like sometimes that just happens. You know, like people say that about relationships. Sometimes people break up and then they grow and then they've grown apart. Separately, they have grown in such a way that now they work in a way they didn't. And they're like, yeah, we needed that time to like find ourselves before we could find each other, you know, whatever. So like for me, some of that was the Bible. Like my appreciation for reading, like my interest in reading and studying the Bible now has nothing to do with being raised as a religious kid. I mean, that gave me background to study it, but like, I don't care about it religiously. I care about it as an ancient text, and my profession is studying and learning about ancient texts. And so, you know, that made it interesting to me again. Suddenly it was a puzzle that it was fun to play with. And it was a totally different way of engaging in it than it was before. But sometimes I think you come back to these things and you underscore the way you first engaged with it. And, you know, one reason I think maybe this comes up sometimes with punk and with a couple other popular music genres is a certain point, like at a certain point in your teenage or early 20s years, you shift in terms of your self-understanding. Up until, you know, your early 20s, you're largely like defining yourself by fiat. You're saying like, I'm going to be about this. And then like you pursue it. And at first you're just whatever you say you're about and you're not really about it because you're not really about anything yet. And then over time it can become like a kind of sincere thing. And I think sometimes as it starts to become sincere, as things start to seem fake to you that you were previously interested in, not because you were fake, but like just, you had interests the way any child has interests. Like it was there, it was interesting enough, but you didn't have like really selective values. You kick it away. That was kid stuff. And then, you know, you grow up and then after time, you don't have to feel this kind of, you don't have to feel like you have to reject it to redefine yourself anymore. You can just sort of look at it neutrally and you can recollect fondly your early engagement with it. So, you know, there was a period of time where I'm sure I would have been embarrassed to say I liked Thundercats, you know, like around the age of like 15, I'm sure I wouldn't have admitted that or something like that. Actually, I might have, but like, I always was pretty open about loving cartoons, but at a certain point, but now I'm like, I'm one of like a million, like late Gen Xer, early whatever comes next people who fetishizes our nostalgia for 80s crap. And like, and so I'm like, yeah, Thundercats was awesome and Lucky Charms and whatever, you know, like I never ate Lucky Charms, but
it's not about eating it. It's about the box. It's about the image.
Exactly.
I mean, so to me, like sugary cereals are like a symbol. Like it's not about, I mean, it's the taste, but really it's about what it represents to a child. I mean, or to an adult who came from the Soviet Union and they walk down that cereal aisle and they start crying. They can't believe that they're actually in heaven. So, you know, past generations, might, you know, if they were still alive, might ask, they're like, so we worked so hard to preserve, you know, religion and tradition and all that. And you're getting seduced by a box of cereal, basically, like you're just going down this egoistic path and giving your soul away or whatever it is, like you're turning your back on all we work to preserve for what? A bowl of or a box of sugary cereal. And I know, like I'm trying to articulate it. It's what it represents. It represents beauty, excitement, efficacy. And the more mature we get, we can conceptualize it. It represents capitalism. It represents individual liberty and reason and all of those things. So a box of Lucky Charms, it symbolizes something great. Now, when it comes to punk rock, to me, it definitely represented like a rebellion against religion, something very individualistic. And then I started to like research on the internet, which back in the late 90s was basically mostly text and pictures, but we were communicating across the world and people basically explained to me online.
And you had to wait half a minute through cappuccino making sounds of your phone connecting as a modem.
And then a picture takes forever to load and a page and all of that. And you don't want to press anything lest you upset the loading process. And, you know, I basically learned that, that it's punk rock versus every other genre and it's punk rock versus the world and punk rock and pop music don't really mix. And for the most part, neither with rap either. And it basically became like my religion. Like I went from, you know, the Jews versus everyone else in like childhood indoctrination. Now it was punk rockers versus everyone else.
Yeah.
And I, For no real reason, there was no reason to do this. There was no need to do this. I turned this newfound love of punk music into like a barrier between me and other people. And I probably missed out on a lot of great opportunities then in my teen years because I wanted to be, kind of separate and in my own little thing.
I mean, like either you conform with the conformists or you conform with the nonconformists. And it's really like, just an alternative conforming thing. I mean, it's not as if the punk or the goth kids don't have their own uniform, don't have their own shibboleths, don't have, you know, but you find your place. I mean, yeah. So I think punk as insofar as punk has a kind of unifying theme or feel, I think it's aggressively anti-traditionalist, aggressively anti-conformist, aggressively anti sort of any pre-packaged moral, intellectual, political item that society is trying to give you in your formative years. And you're just saying, fuck you, right? Like, no, in part because it's phony, it's inauthentic, it's lies, or it's just not you. It's not what you chose. And then sometimes this is taken in a kind of left-wing anti-capitalist way, like this stuff is all commercial. This stuff is all sold to you by companies. This government is sold to you and to sell companies and so on. We're fighting that system. Sometimes it's sold just in a more anarchist way, just straight up like, to hell with any of this system, let's just burn it down. Sometimes it's presented more in a personal way or sometimes it's an anti-religious thing. Sometimes it's just about self-defining and sometimes it's just feeling out of place in the mainstream and just feeling like I don't feel like I belong in this world with these other kids, you know, who came off of an advertisement picture with two, you know, like blonde haired, blue eyed kids on a beautiful manicured New England lawn in their boat shoes. Like, that's not me. I'm not anything like that. I'm never going to be that. What can I be? Right. And I reject the expectation I should be that. And not only do I reject that expectation that I should be that, I am going to throw it back in your face by being as aggressively not that as I can be. And, you know, when I'm not that, you, society, ask me to at least be quiet about it, to at least make myself inconspicuous. And I will not be inconspicuous. I will be loud and vituperative about this. I will shove my uncomfortable self in your face
Yeah. So what was punk rock originally, if you know? I mean, because I picked up bits and pieces. Basically, like you said, like 60s and 70s is probably when we see the first signs of it. There's definitely a hippie revolution happening. And my understanding is like the punks were like, as I think someone on VH1 once described it, and kind of like looking back on what it was, he said like these guys liked watching TV, like, you know, because like the hippies, they're like pure and barefoot, and the punks are like, no, we like watching TV. Yeah, we're hedonistic, but like we also, I mean, yes, we're hedonistic, but we're not like we're not sanctimonious and rejecting cool stuff, like, you know, and we're not gonna play just, you know, easy listening spiritual whatever music. We want to rock, and we want to mosh, and we want to slam some beers, not just sit around and smoke little swag.
So the punk aesthetic is urban. It is not rural. It is not like bucolic in any way. It's not get back to nature. It's like returning to the grimy streets. It's industrial or post-industrial. It is not enamored with folk music. It leans into electric music and into modern instrumentation. It's far more likely to experiment, you know, with synth stuff. It doesn't do too much with that, but like, and all guitars are electric, and, you know, which is why, say, when you get some punk bands or grunge bands, you know, like going on, like part of why Nirvana Unplugged was such a revelation was that it was like so jarring to hear that kind of thing acoustic. But anyway, so I think that's right. But I think that there are certain things that some of the punk aesthetic has in common, like, there's still a suspicion of the mainstream. There's still a kind of suspicion of like of before we knew what it was called, before it was a separate thing, because there was no alternative, you know, legacy media kinds of things like that, to the kind of the official story of the government, that kind of thing. And in general, just sort of anything that the establishment sort of wanted you to believe in and conform to, but it was less idealistic in a sense, right? So I think the punk sensibility is not that like we're entering the age of Aquarius and one day like we can all replace our bombs with flowers. Like, I think the punk sensibility is like any day now Thatcher's gonna drop those bombs on our heads, like or something like that. And
like a disillusionment too, like, yeah, okay, we beat the Nazis in World War II, but like now we're the fascists, like we're living under like it's all like, what's the point anyway? Now we got Watergate and all this stuff.
So it's, there is this, look, I mean, look, punk has its nihilistic elements. It has its resignation kind of elements. There are parts of it that say, you know, like it's hopeless. I think punk at least tends to have the feeling, at least in my mind, the way I think about it, and that's pretty subjective, but is that even when it has resignation, it's sort of saying like, I'm not going to go out without flipping you off first. Like, yeah, maybe you're going to just strangle me and snuff out my flame, but like, I'll burn you first. Like, I won't go gently into that good night, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's that much, because it has a sort of spirit of resistance and rebellion, even when it's extremely unclear why it's rebelling or resisting, and it doesn't really necessarily have any clear ideals about what it's going for, except in a broad way, in a broadly kind of existentialist way, just choice, self-determination in a very vague way. Just not being automatically told what I'm supposed to think and be.
So how do you look at this aspect of it? Like you mentioned, there was always a nihilistic streak to punk rock, which I don't think is a controversial thing to say. Like early punks would have like, they would slap swastikas on themselves. And like, it often wasn't meant to be literal. It was kind of like maybe they're, this again, it's the 70s. They're rebelling against their parents who fought the Nazis, and they're just like, yeah, whatever. And there's that aspect of rebellion against their parents, but also just kind of like, yeah, the symbol is just a sin. It's like if you take this seriously, then you don't get it. But then at some point you do start to see actual Nazi punks walking around. And I know we could say we see these types of patterns over and over. The internet certainly brought about a whole wave of people who just love being shocking. But then at some point you start to see an actual rising tide of actual Nazis or people similar to that who are actually of that ideology. So like, some thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, like the voice of the little sociologist anthropologist in my head says, like, you know, these symbolic gestures have to be understood by the kind of minute context and circumstances of the community in which they're produced. In other words, like I've talked, you know, the first time you see like a skinhead person, like at a ska concert, you're like, what the fuck is that skinhead doing? They're like, no, they're the anti-racist skinheads. And you're like, what the hell is that? They're like, no, they're the skinheads who do that to protest the actual skinheads. And you're like, how does that work? And like, no, it works. Like if you're in that community deep enough, like, you know, all these tropes, and it has this whole elaborate meaning that as an outsider, like it makes no sense to you. And it's just shocking, which is kind of part of the point, but not like the whole point. So I think those things happen. But I also think that, you know, I was trying in preparation for this, I was thinking about like, what do I think are some of the central kind of dimensions or variables or things in punk? And there's always sort of been, on the one hand, there's supposed to be a certain kind of sincerity or authenticity to the message, to what you're doing. But at the same time, it's clearly true that there's always been an element of performativity, theatricality. And they don't always sit happily together. In fact, to some extent, they pull against each other. So like, if you really lean into the sincerity bit, like, you know, you go lo-fi and you play like shit and, you know, the three chords, and you're like, we're just some kids just making music, just saying what we feel, you know? And like, if you really lean into that, like you start to go to authenticity by vulnerability. And then you start to get emo stuff, and you start to get like the Smiths and stuff like that, which is a bridge too far for me, grown as I am, and, you know, like older toxic masculine, or, you know, I just like when Morrissey says like, I'm human and I need to be loved just like anybody else does. I'm just like, oh dude,
cringe.
Come on, man. Save that for your therapist. Like, come on. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to hear you say that. But anyway, but at the other extreme, right? Like, you got to admit, like, there's some stuff, Sex Pistols, or some stuff Iggy Pop and the Stooges were doing, where like, it's just putting on a show, you know, it's really no different than Ozzy Osbourne biting off the bat head, you know? And in that connection, I mean, I think that's where some of that crazy stuff goes, you know, like, yeah, like obviously they had real, like, you know, like God Save the Queen for like the Sex Pistols, and then going on a little barge up and down the Thames, like playing it. Like that was meant to like piss people off, freak people out. So I think even some of the hate symbols that sometimes get appropriated is all sort of part of that shock you kind of thing. And it's funny, like I think of like God Save the Queen on the one hand, and then I think of the song Victoria by the King. And they are no less anti-monarchical, anti-British Empire kind of ballads, you know, like as a statement. But like Victoria sounds like a fun pop song, and like it doesn't sound as angry, even though it's deeply sardonic. And it's not like literally like, fuck you, Elizabeth II, Gloriana Regina, like, it doesn't have that feel to it. So that one gets more of like that's the one we focus on, like, oh my God, you know? But again, cause it's sort of the in your faceness of it. I think other people were sometimes, not all always, but a little more demure. There's certainly something about the kind of punk statement compared to the 60s type protest song that's at least more aggressive. a little scarier to the norms.
And then here's how I think of like the where are they now type of summary of the whole punk rock phenomenon and all of it. To me, so in my view, that whole segment of the population that was into punk, whatever that meant to people, over time, it kind of morphed into two competing groups. And one of them are like the social justice warrior feminist crowd, and the other half are, or roughly half, are actually the pro-Trump, like new age offensive crowd. Like, so to me, these two kind of groups that we've seen in recent years sort of came from that rebellious sort of side of town. And that's kind of how I look at it. So I went and saw Anti-Flag. Do you know that band, Anti-Flag?
Yeah.
So they're very like hard left, you know, like very, very, very well respected punk band from like the early 90s and on. And they were playing in Austin. So I went with Blair White, who is like a known conservative trans woman, and Michael Malice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Michael Malice, who is an anarchist, right? We like anarchy, right? Us punk rockers, but he's obviously not exactly what people like Anti-Flag are, you know, had in mind. So to me, like the whole concept, like the whole looking at this whole situation is just so funny to me that we go to the Anti-Flag show and like we got a trans conservative and an anarchist who's like, you know, whatever he is, he's not exactly on the left. And the actual band playing there, they say nary a word between songs about how we were just under lockdown for 2 years and how they're forcing people or pressuring people to take the vaccine. You know, back in the day, it would have been, are you kidding me? You're going to make us stay home and the corporations are going to introduce this vaccine that we can't trust. But because of the tribalism of today, like the anti-flags of the world, they might require you to be vaccinated to come to their show. So it's like, and they've got a giant swastika behind them with a fist punching it. So if you just glance at it, it just looks like a big swastika. You don't even notice the fist. I didn't catch what you just said a moment ago.
Oh, I said about requiring you to be vaccinated to come to their show. I said, and rightly so, but.
Sure. But like, isn't it kind of ironic looking back?
Yeah, for sure. Like, for sure. Your point is well made that we choose, politics makes strange bedfellows. Allegiances shift. The symbolic meaning of certain things changes. But also, just like, look, I mean, I'm sure there were times when hard left bands went a little easier on. Sometimes they went hard on center left movements and called them sellouts. You know, I don't think Blair had many like fans and so on. But sometimes they might go a little easier on some people and give them a pass because they see them as advancing the overall, you know, cause or whatever it is. And that happens on the right too. Yeah. I mean, people do that and it's curious to see. I don't know, you know, I think that it's different in the UK, but at least in the US, I think that as far as mainstream society, like kind of understood punks, at least when I was growing up, like it was just a nice little fad, a nice little weird fashion kind of people, kind of a pigeonhole to put these people, you know, like they have spiky green hair and they wear like leather with spikes on it. Like they're weird, but they just do that, you know, and they listen to some pretty intense rock kind of music or something like that. But it wasn't really thought of as, I think, at least in the US primarily, or the way it was marketed to people in terms of the politics. Now, once you maybe got into it, you got into the scene and like, you know, you were going to underground shows and you know, you were reading zines and these other, you know, piece of crap pamphlets that people were putting out and stuff. It probably had more of a dimension to it. But I look at some of those old pieces of writing and even that is like, it's very cultural and it's not clear that this is ever organized into like significant political action. I could be wrong. Like, and I'm happy to be challenged by people who are like, I was there and we raised this and we won this campaign. Or, I mean, so maybe it was more politically efficacious, but it always sort of felt to me like it was in the US, it was perhaps safe, you know, from the conspiratorial left perspective, it was like safely neutered. You know, like they had found a way to make punk something that didn't threaten the power system, as if it ever was going to be. But, you know.
Yeah, well, punk. Go ahead. Sorry.
And I will say that, like, there are aspects of the right, the alt-right in particular, that perhaps what they have in common, I think, with some aspects of punk is the tactic of they use cultural shock tactics, right? They do things deliberately designed to offend in order to gather more attention and push their message, right? Like, you might think, like, shouldn't you put your message out in a way most likely to convince people? And, like, it turns out, no. Like, if you just want to move the conversation a little, dilute it to your craziness, you know, make your insanity a little more likely to be talked about. And then CNN's talking about it and you're in the conversation, and now somebody slightly more center than you are is like normal. And like, and you've done it, you know, like, so it's a shockingly effective. I mean, if that's how it works, I don't know, but that could be.
It's hard sometimes to encapsulate something that's just so decentralized. So I think, I mean, punk rock, it got so big when I was growing up and a teenager, like, you had Republican Christian kids in the suburbs that were into punk rock. Like, it was so big and prevalent. Like, nobody could actually say, here's what punk rock, here's the political view that punk rock belongs to. And there's probably always disagreement within even some of the heavy hitters of punk rock. Like, some of them were like, and this is why someone like Donald Trump ends up polarizing the alternative crowd. Like, half of them, or roughly half of them, think punk. They think Donald Trump is everything we wanted. He's anti-establishment, anti-global trade, you know, not politically correct. He's an outsider. The other half are like, are you kidding me? This guy's a billionaire. He's racist, this, that, and the other. Like, he's everything that we were afraid of. He's a fascist. So it's hard to say exactly what punk rockers believe. And I think that lack of focus maybe is a feature of the culture.
Yeah. I mean, like, what do opera fans believe? I don't know. I mean, like, that's like saying what do rich conservatives and rich liberals like? I mean, like, pick a genre and ask what, you know, like, there are some that break down more along socio-political lines. So, like, but not all, you know? So I think that, you're like, you might have thought, given how much punk music talks about society and frames itself in terms of certain standing to society and its institutions, you might have thought punk fans would split, you know, 80-20 on some kind of political thing, or even 70-30, but, you know, maybe not. Yeah.
It's, someone like me who was coming from this like religious background, I definitely wanted to put it all into a box and say punk rock, like, punk rockers must believe this and it needs to be anti-capitalist, anti-establishment. So I'm going to read a few super chats, and the last of which, one of which will prompt my next issue to bring up. Regina, thank you. Thank you, Roland. He says, happy Friday the 13th. I can usually follow along with Philosophy Fridays, but today's topic was over my head. Imagine somebody clicking on this video who has no idea what we're even doing. They see you and they're just like, and they know it's Friday the 13th, and they wonder if they've just stepped into some alternate timeline. Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan again says, great haircut, Jason.
Thank you.
And then Megan says, I have a punk playlist for work. Science prizes conventionality, and I couldn't be conventional if I tried. And now here's the one that prompts me. Action with $10 says, without punk rock, I don't think I would have ever have discovered objectivism. It seems to me it used to be more individualistic, and then Fat Mike ruined everything with Rock the Vote. Sounds like, yeah, the singer of No Effects. It sounds like in the 2000s, they were very anti-Bush, and then the punk rockers definitely put their whole reputation on the line saying, we are anti this, and then next thing you know, punk is
no,
dead altogether.
No, I mean, that's... No? It wasn't Fat Mike. I mean, look, before Fat Mike, Jello Biafra was like saying super crazy far left stuff. Like, and before that, you have the Clash, and, you know, like, and it's like de rigueur that early punk UK bands are in the 80s, like, hate Thatcher and basically think of her as the devil. Like, it's there's always been, I think, that. So, but like, I mean, I don't know if like, I mean, like, even if you think about like some of NoFX's like somewhat like kind of politically leaning songs. They're like pretty amorphous, just like,
oh
you
yeah,
know, the man is bad. You know, like even like Don't Call Me White is
I was going to bring that up. That would be considered like alt-right to sing that today. Same with a lot of other 90s punk songs.
No, really?
Oh, like, yeah. Don't Call Me White.
Everything I hate. Oh, well, but
it's like saying, Don't Call Me White. I'm not responsible for what other white people did. That today would put you in the in a very negative category.
I would have thought of it as like someone else could have said, like, I would have thought the people on the alt-right would have been like, this is white liberal guilt. They feel ashamed that, you know.
No, I mean, I take it. I see it as like him saying, don't blame me for the actions of other people. I'm an individual. But of course, many people today would say calling yourself as a white guy, calling yourself an individual, saying you're shrugging off the responsibility of the systematic racism makes you racist or makes you not part of the solution.
See, I hear it as, you know, when he says like they represent everything I hate. A vast, you know, majority and so on. They're so fucking ordinary. Like, I think of it as him sort of saying, like, it's not that he's saying, I mean, he could be. I don't think it's sort of saying, I'm not one of them. I'm not responsible for any of their stuff. I think it's just sort of saying, like, please don't want me. Oh. I don't want to be thought of as on their side or something like that. But then
he says, does that mean I need to take, does that mean I need to take such shit for being fair skinned? No. I ain't part of no conspiracy. I'm just average
I'm
Joe.
I'm just some average, ordinary. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I think, it could go either way.
With fire.
It would certainly be a song you'd be leery about kind of releasing today.
Like a lot of punk stuff from the past, you know, The Offspring, they had a song called LAPD where they're shouting, beat all the N-words. They mean it like stop being racist, LAPD, but they shouted that song. They don't realize, or they didn't realize, there's no context with which that would be permitted.
I bet you loved The Bruise.
I actually don't know by the NOFX. Yeah, that's my song. That's our song. All right. Yeah, definitely. Okay, we're fast running out of time. So let me bring this up. I discover punk and it, like, you know, and other types of rock music and all this stuff, South Park, all these raunchy stuff that are kind of loosely related to punk rock and that whole thing. And then, of course, I discover Ayn Rand in my mid-teens. And, of course, this is like the biggest life-changing thing. And then the more I learn about Ayn Rand's philosophy, it's almost like, oh, by the way, Ayn Rand hates everything that inspired you thus far. Do you ever see like kind of a conflict or how do you think of this whole thing? Because, you know, I can't be the first one to be kind of grappling with this whole thing.
No, you're not.
Of Rand's aesthetics.
Every so often, I don't know, someone might say something to me at like an Ocon or something. I just brushed it off. And I mean, even the stuff like Ayn Rand wouldn't have liked this sort of thing. I mean, it might have given me pause for a second, but then I, you know, I was usually like, well, you know, Ayn Rand also wouldn't want me to be secondhand. And even the, what would Ayn Rand have liked is the wrong question to ask in the first place. So I'm just, you know, I think it was always like, at that moment, I might pause and think, like, is there anything in this that, like, I don't like? And I might say, yeah, there are things about this I don't like. I never really loved the politics in this. I never really got into that. Does it change your sense of, like, listening to this? I don't know, maybe. Perhaps. But it, you know, it meant enough to me, and it was enough of a value to me that I said, you know, I want this in my life. I respond to it in a deep way. I'm kind of keeping it. And, you know, I think it's, if someone says, you know, like, oh, Jason, like, you've, for example, they say, Tully, you know, you've got anger issues. You shouldn't listen to all this angry music or something. Like, is that nonsense? Is that like just, or is that sense? Like, in other words, like, maybe it's like, yeah. And listening to this stuff helps me get it out of my system and like helps me feel like other people are grappling with this and I feel at home and then I'm not as upset. I mean, like, so the idea of it, even, I just find the whole idea of thinking of your own loves and tastes as a kind of ethical contagion is distasteful to me. I think it alienates you from your values. I think it's more important to find what you like about it rather than to censor your own soul, you know?
Yeah. So I guess like examine it is sort of the answer rather than renounce it and say from now on, it's only romantic realism or and I will be a period. I mean, if you like something that's very far from, you know, let's say Renaissance art, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with that, but it is worth investigating. What is it about this that I appreciate? So let's say
it's
punk
equally
rock.
It's equally worth investigating what's so good about the Renaissance art anyway. Mm-hmm. Right, like, and I say this as, you know, somebody who spent so much time in the classics, but I mean, like, have a good answer to that because, mm-hmm. and get something out of it. Because here's the thing, if for all of its philosophical value and for all of its sort of, its representation of better ideals or something like that, if it just doesn't speak to you, then it doesn't. And, you know, maybe that's something to work on with your therapist and not at the level of, hey, therapist, fix my art, which is like, you know, I want to deal with some stuff, but like you know, in the same way that you, that there be something kind of, so the goal, you know, like if you find yourself, say, attracted to the wrong kind of person, like you explore that with your therapist, you maybe avoid it. Although your engagement with a person in a relationship is very different than with art. But, you know, but if it's the harmful, toxic kind of person, you know, you think about it. What's this to say about me? You work on yourself, you know, you come back to it. I think with you know, with art, it's, you don't, I think, really have to do that in that way. And it's also a little bit kind of funny to be like, well, I want to end up at the end of my life with the right kind of art. You know, no, I mean, if it's speaking to you, you don't have enough time in this life to throw it away.
Mm-hmm. This is rich stuff. Now we only have less than 10 minutes left. Now I asked you if we could each come up with three punk songs, favorite songs to plug, and we can briefly explain why. So since we're running out of time, let's try to not spend too much time on any particular song.
I couldn't come up with only three, but I will try.
Okay. You want to alternate? You go first?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So do you want to go first with one of your songs? Or shall I?
Okay. One of my songs is the Guns of Brixton off of The Clash's third album, London Calling. But it's also shared with just the song London Calling off that album. So I don't actually like the sound of the Guns of Brixton as much as I like the sound of the song London Calling, which I love. But it has like one of the most kick-ass punk rock opening lines to it, which is, when they kick in your front door, how you gonna come? With your hands on your head or the trigger of your gun? I always thought that was pretty.
Yeah. Sad. All right. I guess I'll go next, and I'm going chronologically. Bloodstains by Agent Orange. That's I think that's a real OG old punk song, and it's just, that's like my driving at night on a Saturday night, you know, maybe with a pretty girl, maybe, I don't know, just like going to do something cool, just like there's only the night, there's only the moment. Bloodstains, cheap thrills, fast cars, speed kills, rich girls, fine wine, I've lost my sense, I've lost control, I lost my mind. Now then, in the second verse, he's saying the scene has died away, I haven't got a steady job, and I got no place to stay. It often feels in life like at one point you feel like this scene you're in now is like going to last forever, and then time has passed. I hope you had a backup plan. I hope you saved, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's one, Agent Orange, okay. Bloodstains. Your turn.
I have one. So to just show how far back I will go, 1969, The Stooges, Iggy Pop and The Stooges, from their Raw Power album, I Want to Be Your Dog, or shared with the song Search and Destroy. So that the Search and Destroy is a bit better known, although Want to Be Your Dog is well known. So Search and Destroy is the one that starts out with Iggy Pop going, I'm a street walking Cheeto with a heart full of napalm. You know, I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Look out, honey, because I'm using technology. Anyway, love that whole album. Lust for Life, I think, is on that album. It's just amazing. So all of those.
Nice. Okay. Now, my next one is Bad Religion, Them and Us. So this was after one of the founding members of Bad Religion left to go focus on his major label. The singer had a kind of a crisis, and he rose to the occasion. He might have hired some help songwriting, but nonetheless, the album was Grey Race, and it's a phenomenal melodic punk album. Now, Bad Religion is an important band, both, I think, in punk and also just in terms of like intelligent lyrics. The guy's very intellectual. He's a zoologist. Now, a lot of what he believes, I think we would disagree with. He's into misusing evolutionary language and this and that. He's probably a determinist and stuff like that. But God, it's smart and beautifully written. So a wonderful lyricist. And the song Them and Us is a reoccurring song kind of theme in my life because, you know, like I said, first it's like growing up, it's like the Jews versus everyone else. Then it's punks versus everyone else. Then it's objectivists versus everyone else. It's always, or even just me and someone I like, it's like we need some negativity to contrast ourselves from everyone else. But it's like, but then you just kind of cool down and step back and you're like, reality just isn't that. So Them and Us is a wonderful song. Read the lyrics, listen to it, and help yourself from getting carried away with some of your tribal tendencies. Yeah. Your turn.
Okay. I have the Buzzcocks, Ever Fallen in Love, parentheses, with someone you shouldn't have. Which is off of Love Bites, which I think is their second album. It's 1978. It's the song by far they're best known for. I just really love that song. It both feels punk and it feels emotional and sincere. I just think it's a great kind of sad love song, you know, out of love kind of love song.
Nice. Okay. And then my final one is the song Americana off the album Americana by The Offspring. It's got everything. It's got the melody. It's got the energy. It's about the state of the culture, this very late 90s Jerry Springer culture. And just like kind of the future has arrived. Everything's fast and on demand and everything, but kind of like, now what? Like, now what? This is it. Where are the values? And that to me is a lot of what kind of prompted the rise of punk rock. Maybe going back to the 70s or whenever. It's like we're living in the suburbs. We won the World War. Life standard is rising. But so what? Like, we're not satisfied. We need something more. So Offspring Americana, another song, by the way, which today might be considered as like alt-right or something creepy like that, just because it's like it's dangerously close to some of the to someone saying, well, we need to turn to our ancestors for answers, which is a bit of a creepy place. But yes,
I must mention honorable mentions,
please,
real quick. So the Violent Femmes first album, the self-titled album Violent Femmes, Add It Up and Kiss Off. Those are some of my all-time favorite songs. I love them. I think I'd be amiss if I didn't mention Anarchy in the UK or God Save the Queen off of Nevermind the Bollocks. Here's the Sex Pistols. Here comes the Sex Pistols. And then in terms of like getting more towards your time of punk, Linoleum off of Punk and Drublick. I Know FX. That's a great song. Social Distortion, Story of My Life. Love that song. Green Day's Longview. And then, okay, this is a weird one, but I'm going to throw it out there. This kind of alternative band, I don't think anyone's ever called them punk, but Pulp from England has a song called Common People. Mm-hmm. And Ben Folds Five and William Shatner covered it on an album from 2004 of William Shatner doing like, you know, his weird William Shatner covers where he like talks, sings everything. And it is punk as hell, Common People. And it sounds awesome and I love it. Also, the Muffs cover in 1995 of Kim Wilde's Kids in America, also very cool, very good, like 90s era punk song.
Very cool.
Oh,
cool.
And Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day covered it too.
That's right. Okay, well, we covered a lot here today. I'm very happy with what we were able to cover and from various aspects. Ali, the member, says Americana is considered alt-right. Well, I mean, the views depicted in that song, if said today, and actually a journalist did go back and review that album and that song and said that song sounds like something you would hear from the alt-right, like saying this culture has no values. We need values. And so far, I think that's a good question to ask. Where are our values? But of course, the alt-right often comes up with, you know, a very mystical, like nativist answer that Offspring was not at all going near. But expressing those views would be considered problematic today. That's the point I was making, and that journalist was making, although that journalist was a millennial social justice warrior who actually was renouncing that album. Also, to answer your earlier question, Ali, Dirty Magic was on Ignition and later re-released in 2012 on Days Go By with added distorted guitars. That's all the time we have today. Coming up at 7 p.m. UK time, which is in a couple minutes, it's Finance Friday with Jim Brown on how to invest when inflation is raging. Oh, that's right. Rage is not exclusively a punk rock thing. It's happening with inflation. Thanks, Jason. This was a wonderful discussion. I'm really glad we had it.
Me too.
All right. Me too. Thank you, everybody. And coming up this Monday, it's the 500th episode of The Daily Objective. You're not going to want to miss that. Thank you.
That's awesome.
And goodbye.